And did you declare a business session or something? What do I do there?
You open an organizational meeting.
Okay, yeah. I open an organizational meeting. First order of business is the adopting the committee rules. You have in front of you in your packet a version that's not the version that was emailed to you today. So the version that I'm proposing we vote on is the one in front of you with 14 items on it. Is there any discussion on the committee rules?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
I note that the version that you have in front of us, which would be draft 2, is distinct from the one that was sent out earlier in that it deletes the what was paragraph 13 in regard to minority reports.
That's right.
With the language that was inserted in House rules yesterday and also, as you're aware, subject of much debate.
That's right. And I was trying to avoid to continue that debate today by not putting it in front of us.
Which I understand, even though, thank you, Mr. Chair, if I might continue, that the committee might strip that out, but is still bound by House rules. So it is really irrelevant if it is in the rules or not in the rules. We're still bound by the rules of the House chamber.
Yeah, but I'll only accept in order debate that's on what you have in front of you, not debate that what's not in front of you.
Well, that's just delightful, Mr. Chair, but I think that it does go to what you are trying to accomplish. Are we bound then, Mr. Chair, I might ask, without the provision of minority report in this current form in front of us by the chamber rules?
All committees are bound by the chamber rules.
Okay, thank you. Then with that being said and without it being clearly written in our committee rules, I will advise you that I will be voting no.
And the basis of that is there's something here you object to?
That it's not set out specifically in regard to how to handle minority reports in our committee structure.
I'll be happy if you'd like to amend all of the House rules into the committee report if you think that would be useful.
Mr. Chair, I would not even think that would be, deign to think that would be efficient or effective, but because that one particular piece I think is germane, I think that it should be reflected in our operating rules of the committee. But since you do not choose to have it in there, I'm fine with the rest of the rules. I just will be voting no in that particular because of that omission.
Would you like to offer an amendment to add it so you can vote against them with the amendment you want in?
That is certainly within your prerogative and
purview. No, I was asking if you wanted to do it.
I was not able to be here, and so I have to get up to speed. So I'm listening now. I'm not sure which provision.
Provision 13 of the rules that were.
Isn't in here. She's objecting to a piece of the rules that aren't here.
That were provided earlier to us as committee draft rules.
But they've been deleted?
They have been deleted sitting in front of us.
They're not in front of us. What you have in the version, I had thought debating the House rule that we debated all day yesterday wasn't really functional for the behavior of the committee. So since I heard from the last committee meeting I was in, it was an objectable to members of the minority, respecting the rights of the minority, I have in front of you rules that don't have things that are objectable to you. Now I'm having objection to the fact that I don't have something you can argue against.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the sensitivity that you're approaching and trying to accomplish here, and I'm not trying to pick a scat. What I'm suggesting is we are nonetheless bound by the rules of the House chamber, which we voted on yesterday, which make a very strenuous provision for the minority report process.
That's
and
right.
Not to have it set out in these rules, I think, while it might take away from the debate or perhaps the sensitivity, I think is a glaring omission.
Well, the issue is we are bound by House rules. And having redundantly repeating a House rule in a committee rule doesn't seem useful. Everything else in the committee rules specify how we act specifically in regard to House rules that aren't in the House rules. Having something redundant didn't seem to me useful. When I asked the chief clerk of the House why that it got in there in the first place, the answer was in prior sessions, the House rules weren't as specific with regard to minority reports. So there was the House rules, and then the committee template had specific issues about how the committee behaved differently. Since So when they were creating the template, they simply went along with that. But rather than putting anything different, they redundantly, exactly repeated the House rule and the committee rule, which seemed to me to be superfluous and creating arguments.
I have a question for you, though. 13 does say that there has to be prior notice of any proposed amendment at least 48 hours prior to a work session, and yet the House rules allow that there could be a Senate bill brought in and only have 24-hour notice. And so it's possible that we would be unable to provide an amendment language 48 hours in advance of having a hearing and a work session.
These are amendments proposed by other than House members.
Okay. All right. Let me see that again.
It's for outside. So it happens if an outside person, this says, proposed amendments by other than members of the Legislative Assembly.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. I was scanning too quickly.
Yeah. Is there any other discussion on the House rules? Do we have a motion on the floor?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules for the 2008 special session.
Any further discussion?
I would like to say that my understanding of committee rules are that they only apply to the committee, and if a provision that was objectionable in another committee is not presented in these committee rules, then it's like it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't see a problem with these rules. Thank you.
Would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 President Cannon?
Aye.
President
Flores?
No.
President Gelser? Excused.
President
Maurer?
No.
Vice Chair Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye.
Rules are adopted. Motion passes and rules are adopted. I'm going to open a public hearing. Oh. Somebody's got to tell me where this gavel thing came from. Some historian here. I open a committee hearing on House Bill 3614, and kind of administrator, can I request that you get all the testimony on LC 62 that we heard in the interim and enter that testimony into the House record for HB 3614. Thank you. Can I call representatives of DHS to the whoever's brave enough to join us? It turned out that language in the current version of 3614 created a modest fiscal of $374 million total funds and $150 million, $149.2 million general funds. It turns out that big pieces of that, my reading, and Senator Richardson and Representative Kotek met with folks in DHS yesterday, and it's our reading that big chunks of language in the version of the bill triggers things in this fiscal, legitimately triggers them. And what I've asked them to do to testify today on two issues. One is to specify which pieces of the fiscal relate specifically to which pieces are language in the bill. My intention to eliminating say $148.5 million of the $149.2 million that's in the fiscal. So I've asked Ledge Council, who's here to listen to this, I've asked the LFO representative to tune in on the hearing today, so that when we come out of here today, the objective would be to create a set of amendments to the current version of 3614 that would eliminate any confusion of what we intended. And my sense of what we intended were two things: the extension of the 6 month eligibility to 12 months, and especially as it relates to Plum kids, and Plum means
poverty level.
Poverty level medical?
Poverty level medical and not TANF, and we'll have the discussion to relate specifically only to the 6 to 12 month extension of eligibility and to the grant program. And we'll try and find out how to perfect the bill so that it narrows it down to that once we've heard the discussion. Jim, are you lead off or who's?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Edge. I'm a DHS assistant director, and I'm an administrator of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. Yes, it did take some bravery to come over here today after the big fiscal that we had put on this bill, but we're here today to explain that to you, and as you had requested, to break it out into components so that you can see where the components are and where the pricing comes from. We also brought with us some options today, so as you think about changes to make or pieces of the bill that you might want to leave or remove or change, we'll write some information about that. As we had talked in some of your interim committee meetings, as we were discussing Legislative Concept 62, there's four major components of this bill that have a cost to them. One is the references to the outreach. Another is the program cost that comes as a result of the caseload changes. Another is the 6 to 12 month eligibility change that Chair Greenlick just discussed, and another is the access grants that are discussed in the bill. And Judy Moore Peterson is here with me today to talk about more of the fiscal part of it. Judy's the deputy of our finance and policy analysis section, or
section.
Okay. And we'll go through that, and Judy will lead us through some of that. I may just start by discussing outreach a little bit, because I know there was a question about the outreach and what does the outreach component of this fiscal buy. The outreach that we priced based on what's in the bill, and much of it carried over from what would have been in Healthy Kids bill, buys 8 staff in DHS. There are 6 operation and policy analysts, 1 public affairs specialist, 1 operation policy analyst to coordinate the grants that would be administered. There's component of the cost, and that amounts to about $615,000. There's a component of the outreach cost, which is all the materials. There's the flyers, the patient education, the outreach materials, the postage, distribution, marketing materials. There's a media effort. There's training efforts. And then there's outreach grants. And the outreach grants, we had priced 38 outreach grants at $50,000 each to go out to outreach sites, community health centers, and safety net clinics to assist with the outreach component of this. And then there's that adds up to about $2 million in costs. There's about $1 million in admin costs, and it totals up to the approximately $3.7 million you see there as the total fund outreach cost in this biennium. I'm going to turn it over to...
And 2.9 in the next, right?
General fund cost of 2.9 in the next biennium, yes. Yes. I'm going to turn it over to Judy Moore Peterson now and let her walk you through the components of this and also the options that are on the 3 pages of the handout that you've received.
For the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I am a Deputy Administrator for the Finance and Policy Analysis within the Department of Human Services. You should have in front of you a handout with three pages, 3 options. The front page is House Bill 3614 as it came to us, and it is broken out, as Jim mentioned, into those 4 sections. This looks a little bit different than what we had yesterday in meeting with several of you on the committee. The first two boxes are the outreach component, which ties to Section 1 and 2 within the bill. The first part ties with the what it would cost to actually do the outreach, the staff, the resources, services and supplies, what it would take to actually do the outreach. And the next box, number two, would be the sort of, so to speak, the outcomes of those outreach efforts. In other words, we would expect in these additional caseloads, we would expect these additional people to come on, and then there would be some additional costs, admin costs on that side as well, to be able to handle the additional caseload coming in. So that's the one and two here. Are there any questions on that?
Yeah, if we delete section one in its entirety, does that wipe out the whole of the top box?
Section 1 would delete the top box. Yes, I believe it would.
Great. Representative Cote?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, by the way, both of you, for working on these numbers, coming with the detail we need. We're on a very fast timeline. It pains me a little bit to spend so much time talking about budget in a policy committee, but given where we are in the session, we need to really look hard at what things are going to cost and what we want to pass on. In Section 1, mm-hmm. Subsection 1, where it refers to streamlining and simplifying the program mm-hmm. application process, is there a cost to that? As it's written right
Chair now. Greenlick and Representative Kotek, we are doing streamlining and simplification anyway, so that's a process that's ongoing right now. The move to the two-page application for children is a big part of that, and so, no, I don't think there are costs built into this fiscal for that streamlining.
There were some additional efforts that we were going to put into easing, simplifying the process, for example, creating a web-based online application. There were some additional efforts that we had built in for to accomplish what we felt was the intent or how it was written. Some of those costs are there, but the simplified application of the two-page application is going forward, and there's not a there's not any admin costs associated with that in here.
Thank you, Paul. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hello, Representative Kogan. If I just make comment just mm-hmm. briefly. This is a little unusual for us to be involved in the fiscal, but I did check with the co-chair, and it was very much their preference that we perfect the bill, at least to be the bill we want it, so they can deal with the fiscal that comes.
Right? Oh, absolutely, Mr. Chair. I'm just expressing a philosophical dislike of normally, you know, we like to talk policy and let budget go elsewhere, but because unfortunately sometimes we make poor policy decisions based on budget expectations. But Section 1, if we are to move forward and perhaps remove parts of Section 1 because of their fiscal impact, I would like, if at all possible, to keep Section 1, Subsection 1, because I think it's an intent we want to have, talking about reducing red tape, simplifying the application, if there's a nominal or zero cost to that, other than Section 1, Sub 2, and 3, I think are the ones that are driving more of the fiscal, and I just wanted to put that out there.
Is that the case?
You know.
Go ahead.
Your call.
Chair Greenlick and Vice Chair Kotek, we will go back and look at this in detail once you decide on which sections to remove or leave. But there aren't high costs associated with any of what you're talking about keeping, which is the streamlining attempts. And as we talked a minute ago, there are streamlining efforts going on right now, which are things we were going to do anyway, even though Ballot Measure 50 did not pass the Healthy Kids. We wanted to go ahead with some of those streamlining efforts, and they will continue, and so they're not part of this. If there are some additional streamlining efforts, and maybe Judy can tell me if there are, there may be small costs associated with those, which will have to stay in a new fiscal if we leave that section there, but I think they would be small.
Right.
Thank you.
Senator Gelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope you'll indulge me in a newcomer's conversation. This is the first time I've seen these numbers, and it's entirely possible that I'm misreading the sheet here. But if I'm reading it correctly, it looks like this makes the argument that Section 1, Sub 3, which talks about facilitating outreach and enrollment efforts, would be $24 million in total funds this year and $116 million in total funds in the next biennium. Can you...
No, actually 26.5 because it's box one and box two.
Which way are you going? Is it box one, box two, or box one, box two? In any case, can you describe
on the far left hand side? It says bill options.
Correct.
1, 2, 3, 4. Correct. I believe those are the boxes that right. Representative Greenlick is referring to.
And I'm looking specifically at box two, mm-hmm. under the outreach caseload program under adults, and it references Section 1, Sub 3, which is the facilitation of outreach and enrollment efforts. Mm-hmm. And I'm just...
Why don't we ask them to explain
that? Yeah, can you explain what that is? Because I'm having a hard time understanding it.
We'll get down through all four of those, okay. But right. We started with one. We started questions, and maybe in an hour, whatever, should we go on? Why don't we try and go through all four?
Continue.
Yeah, why don't you go through all this page, and then we'll ask
okay.
all the questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, if you... extend down the page, and you look at bill option 3 or box 3.
What about 2?
Pardon?
What about 2?
Those are the caseload costs.
Explain 2, please.
Sure. Those are the caseload costs that we would expect to be a result of the outreach efforts that we would put in place. And so the way that the wording is, which is a little bit different than the wording that existed within that Healthy Kids legislation, which you may be remembering, is that the addition of outreach efforts to families. And when you're doing the outreach efforts to families, you're targeting the whole family. And so you would anticipate some adults, for example, within a TANF case, would come on. And so this is an attempt on our part to account for those adults. It's not from any other group. For example, we're not pricing in here the OHP standard population, for example, even though I'm sure that it would add to that population if it was open, but it's a capped program. So that the adults here are adults that would be coming in with a TANF medical caseload. I should clarify. Is that helpful?
Yeah, so clarification. I think the way that I had read this, it looked like that was the cost of the publicity, and that was
no.
That's actual medical. That's covering people.
Right. You're bringing
that makes
people
so
in,
much more sense.
And that's like they're on the Oregon Health Plan. These are all the medical costs, et cetera. From
there are people that come in as a result of the outreach because we talked about outreach.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that includes TANF and not just Plum, right?
Several.
Up here on the children, the children would include all eligibility groups, would be, you know, kids. There may be some who are in the age of the blind or the disabled eligibility category. It would be children who are in the CHIP, children who are in the poverty level medical children, TANF related children. So it's all eligibility groups. The adults, the only category that we would anticipate adults coming in would be the TANF medical.
And again, the basic question, if we deleted Section 1, all of Box 2 goes away?
You know, I would really, really hate to be held to that, but in my...
So no, we're going to have to go back and look
so.
At it.
So.
Okay.
But we would definitely take a look at that and make sure.
On to 3.
Okay. The number 3, the bill option number 3, is the 6 to 12 month recertification. And here we did separate out two different groups that we felt would be affected by this because of the way the wording of the bill was. all children being moved to a 12-month certification, and that would, we anticipate that would affect both the poverty level medical children, which we call Plum kids, and then the TANF kids. We also have an admin cost, which we didn't have yesterday. It's actually not a cost, it's a savings. The reason that the savings is so large in that first biennium is that you're capturing the savings from moving all the whole poverty level medical children caseload, which there's about 83,000 to 84,000 children, to that 12-month certification. So you're capturing that savings, within that time period. And then you don't have that savings anymore in the roll-up in the 09-11. I also do want to note that those admin costs or savings, they're almost entirely related to the poverty level medical children. They are not related to the TANF. So I merely call your attention to that because there has been some discussion about limiting it to the poverty level medical children. And you would see very little change in your admin costs or savings by changing the TANF numbers.
Very little increase in the reduction.
or reduction in the cost in 09-11, right.
And if we really intended to only deal with Plum, as I thought we had only intended, and we'll talk about that later,
mm-hmm.
you would take out this TANF kids, which
right.
would be 0.6 in the first biennium, and 12.8 rollover.
Correct.
Okay, great. Now box four?
Box four is the access grant.
Yes, hold on. Yeah,
I have some questions about how that would be implemented. Should I wait?
Because yeah, let's wait. There's a question about the numbers and where they come from. Let's bring those up. Representative Cannon?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you explain why the roll-up costs are so great on this box three, given that the implementation date is halfway through this biennium, July 1, 2000.
Well, I would be delighted.
And there are some alternatives to that date in
right.
the next two pages.
Right.
So, just in case that question was asked, Representative or Chair and Representative Cannon, I did bring, it's not a very pretty graph, but I think that this kind of demonstrates the
Is that the same survival analysis you gave me yesterday?
It's not the survival analysis, but I did include the survival analysis in the handouts. So it's not a very pretty graph, but what you're looking at is if you have an implementation date of July 1 of 2008, you're changing your eligibility from 6 months to 12 months. There's a 6 month delay before you're going to actually start to see the slow accumulation of the additional children coming on. So the line you see there is the end of the first biennium, and as you can see, the difference between the transparent diamonds and the black circles, that's your cost, that's your caseload cost, it's those covering those additional children, whereas if you go all the way out to the end, you can see there's a lot more, you're accumulating a lot more and you have a lot more time, the 24 months to accumulate that cost, and that accounts for the large increase in your roll-up.
Thanks, that's very helpful.
Well, and I'd like to spend a little more time later really discussing this graph and how we get to 18,000 at the end, but that's a very important question.
Okay.
This implies by the end and the steady state there'll be 18,000 in addition,
mm-hmm.
and 3,000 of those for some period, 3,082 in this biennium. I suppose that's an average.
Right.
Okay, box four.
Okay. Actually, before we move on to the box four, I'd like to just add one more thing on the TANF children. The question marks aren't there because we were debating whether they whether they were, should be included or not. They, we believe that they should be included. It's just a matter of
you believe that
the
we intended to.
No, I don't know what you intended.
You believe that our language,
written,
as
right.
it's written, includes them.
Correct. And so, but there is still some question as to how much. The certification processes for TANF are very, very different than what they are for the poverty level medical children. And so we have put an estimate in there, but we have a lot more work to do quickly on what that estimate is. But we've left it there because we believe that the language of the bill is such that they would be included.
Would you tell us where, not right now, but mm-hmm. one of the things, would you tell us where you think the language of the bill leads you to believe that? Because we didn't think we did, and we can make it explicit by saying it doesn't include TANF, but if there's something in there that you think really does that would be very useful for us to know. But again, hold that question. Let's go on with the numbers.
Okay. So,
no, you want to go with that question?
No, I just have a serious questions, and so...
Write them down, and we'll let you go right through all of them.
Okay.
One after the other. Let's do box four, and let's just glance at what you have on the next pages as well.
All right. So box four, we've actually redone based on input from our conversation yesterday, so that the access grant, the grant dollars themselves, are total $1 million over the two biennium, and then there's an additional admin costs. It's a representative of a 0.5 FTE within public health. And it's in the first year, it would be 0.25 because it's only for 1 year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what have you got on these other pages just very briefly, and then we'll turn the committee loose with, I think, a ton of questions.
Okay. On the next page, we provided some additional information for your benefit. If you move the 6 to 12 month recertification implementation date from July 1 of 2008 out to October 1 of 2008, these are our estimates of the case load impact and the admin costs and savings. And then the next page, the grant is more or less the same, based on a July 1, 2008. And then the third page is changing the implementation date for the 6 to 12 month recertification from...
This says in the October 1st one that mm-hmm. it would end up with a net savings rather than a net cost in the 07-09.
Right. And again, it's okay. Because you're applying the whole... You're working through the entire caseload on the poverty level medical children, and that's, as I mentioned, is 83,000 to 84,000 children.
And if TANF was out of that, it would end up being minus 0.3, right?
No, you... Well, right. Yes.
Okay, and the next page?
The next page is changing that implementation date again, moving it out even further to a January 1, 2009 implementation date. You would not see an impact at all in the present biennium, even that because, of course, it takes 6 months for that impact to be before you would start seeing the slow, gradual increase in the number of children. So, and that wouldn't happen until the 09-11.
And it also reduces the roll-up cost.
Yes, it does.
Okay. Let's see. Mr. Vice Chair first, and then Representative Maurer.
And that's fine.
No, you.
Well, okay. I wanted to talk about
Morgan,
not finance.
Oh. Okay. Questions in that. Let's do that.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Let's go with your list.
Okay. First off, I think that in the original agreement when we started drafting LC 62, that we always caveated the agreement with what can we afford. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, clearly, besides the Ways and Means co-chairs and that, it's within our committee, we're also looking at the cost because, obviously, we've got some substantial roll-up costs. So mm-hmm. I think we need to be cognizant of that.
Right.
And I'm going to be very skeptical of something that rolls out $250 million in two biennium down the road. So
Wouldn't let's say we take the last option run. Wouldn't the 26 million general fund be roughly what it would be in the 09 marginal cost in the 11-13?
I'm not disagreeing with that.
I mean,
if you went to the next biennium, 12-13, then you're looking at roll-up costs of in excess of $100 million.
Where does that come from?
Well, I'm looking at the at first page, box number two.
Ron, no question. I think box number two needs to disappear.
Another biennium down the road, no matter which option you choose, page one, two, or three, that roll-up cost gets really big going down the road.
I think that, well, and we do need to talk about this, and we need to talk about it with LFO, but it's my impression that if you go to the last page, the 26 million roll-up cost, 26.2, is... Well, no, let's go back one page. The 30 million roll-up cost that's in 09-11 is basically a steady-state caseload component.
Right.
It could change for the cost per case, but the roll-up of just doing the 6 to 12-month should be something at 30 million plus inflation in the 11-13 budget.
Let's put the TANF kids in it.
I think we got to get rid of the TANF kids.
That brings that number down, though.
That's right. Oh, that's right. It actually brings it
down.
It actually brings it down if we take the TANF kids. So
So
11-13 should be similar to what's on page 2 plus inflation, I think. Is that your sense of?
Yes.
I mean, we're at about steady state at that.
Correct.
Right. The steady state, whatever that is. I still don't get it because I'm looking at page 1 and you've got a roll-up cost on page 1, box 2 of $65 million general fund for outreach caseload.
It's my intention, Ron, that we write this bill
I understand.
Box 1 and box 2 disappear.
Okay.
So that all we have left is box 3 minus TANF and box 4.
Okay.
That's where I think we need to go.
Okay. Next question. There appears to be some confusion in the audience about outreach grants and the access grant, which is section 3 of the bill. And the outreach grants that are on page 1, box 1, mm-hmm. are a completely different thing. We're not talking about the access grant program, so that's, am I correct, a totally separate issue?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Maurer, that's correct.
I don't understand the question, Ron. Would you help me with it?
Well, there's some confusion about the terminology of using, if you look at page 1, box 1, of the term outreach grants.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I got you.
That created right. some confusion that somehow right. that bled over into Section 3, and it doesn't.
That's right. Exactly right.
Okay.
It doesn't bleed over into Section 3, and Section 3 is what's on so-called box 4.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Last line of questioning, and I will stop.
Whatever.
Right now. And that is about the streamlining and simplification. And you mentioned online application, and I don't believe that we ever discussed online application. Now, I think I would be supportive of that kind of thing, but we were also, several committee hearings ago, told by the director that they never do anything unless the legislature is on board because of the financial issues. And so I'm a bit concerned that you've added, I don't read it in here. You know, it doesn't say anything about online, so you've, like, interpreted what we've said and taken it one step further.
I think, Chair Greenlee and Representative Maurer, I think if you read through, you know, Section 1, Part 1, and then you keep reading and it says providing assistance, and it really is an effort to streamline our processes and make them as helpful as possible. And when we did the fiscal for what we saw, what was written down, we included those elements to it as far as well, what are the things that we could do to streamline our processes, to make it so that we can process the applications more quickly, that we can make them easier to fill out, make them more readily accessible for our clients. And so all those were taken into consideration.
And so we could, I think, in fact, this doesn't require legislation. This does not require statute. You're doing it already.
We're doing parts of it already. We don't have a...
I'm sorry to interrupt, but did this legislature say go ahead and do it? I don't think... We may have said it offline,
they
but
think there must be enough words in here to lead them to believe we intended things that I never intended, at least, and I'm not sure anybody else.
I mean, streamlining the bureaucracy clearly is a goal we all want to achieve, I hope. I'm just confused about what DHS does and how they interpret things and then kind of make it their own, and then when they don't want it to make it their own, then they distance themselves. That's where I get a little bit
concerned. Chair Greenlink and Representative Maurer, Patty O'Sullivan's going to help us out.
Thanks.
Yeah, how come you were hiding before?
For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Department of Human Services. Chair Greenlink, Representative Maurer, in a budget the size of ours, in a department the size of ours, I mean, there's lots and lots of things we do and change without coming over here. Major policy we would not change without coming over here. If we need a new database and we haven't been funded for it, we would have to come here and get the funding and then, convince you that we need that database and why we need it. We've been wanting to make, and our advocates and clients and providers have wanted to make the application process simpler. Everybody is in agreement to that. There's ways to do that are cost effective, and that's changing the application, seeing where the boxes go, if we really need the box, not need the box. And then there's other electronic ways. If on a web-based application, I mean, we have staff that do web-based applications, and if it's not a project that would increase staff or that we need a piece of equipment for, and that we can fit it in duties, current duties and current staff, and it's the right thing to do, and we have an advocate group that has walked this through this with us, then we would do it. And if we needed to come back here to ask you for something to do it, that's not what I would call a major policy change. That's something to make our clients' lives easier and more accessible to services, and that's our job.
Okay.
Except, Patty, the issue is here, I think Representative Maurer, is you apparently thought there's something in Section 1 that triggered a significant policy shift to the tune of about $5 million. So, I mean...
Well, Representative Greenlink, there was a policy shift there, and that was to go out and try to capture all the folks out in Oregon that are currently not on one of our plans, and to go out and actively seek them out and help them apply and help them, and that's what most of the outreach is for.
You currently don't see that as the mission of DHS, to go out and find people who are entitled to receive services and make it easier for them to get them? That's not in your...
Chair Greenlink, no, it's not, because you give us a certain budget to live with, and the people come to us. Right now, as you know, we have one program standard that's capped because we can't afford all the people on it. FEOP has a waiting list because they can't afford all the people on it. On Medicaid health plan, when they come to us, we put them on if they're eligible, and we move forward. But no, we don't have an outreach program. We have small outreach programs, of course, but we don't have an active large outreach program because we don't have the capacity.
Right. This is off topic because I really do intend to take Section 1 out, but it really would be interesting, and I really need to hear it from Bruce as well, that your policy, because you have a budget, is to sit back and wait for people to show up who are eligible for services. Is that basically the operating policy of the department?
That would be a Jim question.
Chair Greenlee.
Well, I expect it is normally
in a sense that is true. We cannot do any kind of an extensive outreach effort right now because our budget is based on an expected caseload growth, which doesn't include that outreach. And as soon as we begin doing outreach, whether it's in the form of advertising in the media or sending out brochures or all of the other things that we listed here that would be a part of a more extensive outreach effort, that does increase caseload, and it creates costs not only for the outreach activity itself but for the services then provided to the increased caseload. And it's not that we wouldn't like to provide services to every person who's eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. It's that our budget is based on a caseload growth which is not expecting that outreach effort. And as soon as we begin doing that outreach effort, the caseload grows faster and our costs go up and we don't stay within budget.
Well, this is something I think, and not today, but I'd really like to have an informational meeting with your leadership on this, perhaps before we leave. I mean, it seems to me the policy, your policy objective ought to be to deliver services to everybody that's eligible. Now, you have constraints on that. But you also have a way to deal with the fact that if we have a recession and your TANF caseload goes up, you have a way to come and ask for more money. I mean, you're not, in fact, told you can't increase this caseload in the basic Medicaid population. You have a budget, and if it increases, you have to come and ask for more money.
This is a discussion for a policy committee, but having been involved in the Ways and Means aspect of it, there's no time that we're saying, I'll tell you what, why don't you increase the population of this program by 5% over the next 2 years, and we'll just provide extra money to cover that. It's always, what are the projections? Why are those projections so high? And what is going to be the real cost? Because it's trying to keep DHS at a very limited budget so that the excess funds can go elsewhere, but I'm sure the agency would be happy to do full outreach if we would just come up with $100 million, and so it's a policy issue, but it's a financially driven decision.
I understand practical realities. I mean, I know I have a lot of interest in how to spend money at home, and
we're
basically limited by how much money you got.
If we had a constitutional amendment about this,
that might be a different issue. That's right. Or if we had a plan out of 329 to deal with the fact that we leave $1.5 billion of federal money on the table by not expanding the Medicaid coverage. But this is not today's discussion.
At risk of alienating you, you usurped my question time.
I thought you should have done it. You can have all the questions you want, sir.
There is one more thing, and it is about the access.
You never alienate me, Representative Ma. You know that.
About the access grant program on page one, because all the figures are the same. If I calculate it correctly, then it looks like the grant admin is 16% over the life of the grant. Is that?
Chair Greenlee and Representative Maurer, we actually had to do this very, very quickly. There were some things we concentrated on and some other things that we said we're going to have to come back to. These are estimates, although they're as good as we can get at this point. Except for that grant admin, we left it the same. Judy and I, kind of misinterpreted the bill, and at one point we had the grant money from the top down with the grant money from the bottom, and we did it, and there's a blank in the bill. We didn't really know how much that was, so we sort of made it up as we went along. What we didn't have time to do, because these will happen in public health, we did not have time today to go back to public health and say, okay, here's the exact amount of the grants. There'll be four grants, $250,000 each one time. Can you look at your admin costs and break them down and redo it? I've actually just talked to Joel Young, who's here, and he said, yeah, we'll go back and look at it again. We just did this very quickly there in Portland, okay. And we just didn't get there.
And,
so.
And I would also suggest that maybe the grant admin is actually part of the grant so that you don't, you know, that if it's a $250,000 grant, $10,000 of it goes to administering the grant from DHS.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer, I made that decision at 2 o'clock today to have the grants be exactly $1 million and add on the administration so that that decision was made. Because
okay.
they actually had it rolled in at first, and I said bring it out because they were specific about the amounts of grant to me. So.
Okay. No, I'm done. Thank you.
Other questions? Can we talk a little bit about that 18,000 if there aren't other? Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. Oh, Representative Cannon, Representative Richardson, Representative Kotek.
Oh, no, I didn't know.
I didn't have anybody here to keep an eye on me. Representative Richardson, do you have any more?
Actually, I have a question on wording, but it's probably going to end up being an LC question.
Well, let's try it.
Okay. I'm on page 2 of the bill, section 2, the last B and C, so let's see.
Page 2, section 2.
Section 2, 4, B and C. And if you get rid of some of the extraneous wording in B, it says the department will re-enroll so long as each child is a legal resident of Oregon and is eligible for medical assistance on the date of re-enrollment. And then in subparagraph C, it says the department must determine the person's eligibility for medical assistance using information and sources available to the department. And we assume that they wouldn't make that determination on sources that weren't available to the department. But if it's available to the department, I mean, that I'm not sure what that's intended to say, since...
Or on documentation available.
It says, or on documentation readily available to that person. I assume this is all relating to the antecedent, which is medical assistance. It has nothing to do with legal residence of Oregon. That would probably continue.
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, we had that conversation with the individuals in our eligibility determination section, and they talked about the fact that today we currently do that in many cases. We don't require a whole new application. We require an update of an application. We require, in some cases, simply a verification of that their income is still the same or still below a certain level. So we interpret this section as continuing that process of making it as easy as possible for people to stay on the program, not requiring whole new applications, but simply requiring an update of their information. And we'll continue to do that.
And that they're still legal residents.
Thank you.
Can we talk? Do we have the right people here to talk about that 18,000? Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Representative Cook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple comments. I really do appreciate the conversation about what the mission of the department is. And, you know, when you do outreach, people come, people get on the caseload. You know, we haven't had that frank of a conversation for a while, I think, in this building. We assume everything, you know, that we're trying to serve everyone, but then we don't do the outreach. So I think your numbers are really helpful because it does show when you do some level of outreach, you do increase the caseload. It was one of the reasons we needed Healthy Kids because of the revenue needed to cover, you know, the kids that would come on if we actually did something more than, you know, the average sit around and wait. In terms of Section 1 around streamlining, I know it might seem redundant because you have started doing some of this, but I think the two statements in Section 1, Sub 1 about that the department shall have policies and procedures to streamline is important to keep there because when administration changes or times change, I think this is a policy intent that we should have in statute, as well as the second line there that talks about, and when you do these forms, you're actually consulting folks who would use them. I'm not saying that's not happening now. You're doing things that are great. We want that to happen for posterity, so that's why I'd like to keep that section in there. And then the last comment, I'm sure we're going to get into a little bit about the six-month recertification and why the numbers increase the way they do. I mean, we've created this de facto drop-off at 6 months to maintain the caseload to some degree, and I'd rather have the discussion of let the roll-up happen and have the conversation about capping the program because doing 12-month continuous enrollment is a better policy. It saves money. It's a better way to do the program. If we have to have the discussion about, well, can we afford to have that many kids on, that's a different conversation. So I just want to make sure that I'm happy to have that discussion, but I think 12-month continuous enrollment as it's written in is the best policy, the best way to run the program, and something we should just do because it makes more sense.
No, I don't disagree with that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Kotek, we agree, too, that we would like to cover these people. I would point out, though, that the poverty-level medical program is a mandatory Medicaid population, and once we extend the eligibility period, we can't cap that program. That's a mandatory population, a categorical population under the Medicaid guidelines of the federal government. So we're not able to cap that program like we can our OHP standard program.
And follow up on that, we couldn't cap the poverty level medicals, and I don't want to cap that, but that would be a budgetary discussion. But we could cap SCHIP. Could we not? That is not an entitlement program. Because we're covering, you know, kids at higher incomes through SCHIP, it would be a trade-off.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kotek, our SCHIP program is based on an allotment, and it is, in a sense, capped at the point we can stop drawing down on our SCHIP allotment. But we also, under the terms and conditions of our demonstration project, are providing coverage to kids up to 185% of the federal poverty level, which includes that SCHIP group. So we would need to go back and get some changes in our waivers from the federal government if we were wanting to stop covering kids in that group. Not that either you or I would ever want to do that, but we would have to get some waiver changes to do that.
Thank you.
The poverty level, is that not 185?
If
it is 185, the same as SCHIP, or is it of poverty level, or is it 100%?
It's not 100.
Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson, the poverty level medical program is the mandatory Medicaid population, the categorical population. That's the population that is covered up to 100% of the federal poverty level for children from 6 to through 18. It's covered up to 133% of the federal poverty level for children 0 to 6. And then the add-on to that, the stacking above that, is the SCHIP program. The coverage from 100 or 133% of federal poverty level up to 185% of federal poverty. That's SCHIP.
Okay, so a follow-up. So in the calculations determining these numbers, you're factoring in SCHIP's money, which is another pot.
No, that's already 12 months.
Representative Richardson, we've already extended the eligibility period for SCHIP qualified children to 12 months. We did that as a result of a waiver with the consultation with the legislature in the last legislative session.
Okay, so this, what we're discussing, this money that would go toward expenditure here is for children 0 to 6 at 133% of poverty, and 6 to 18 or 7 to 18 at 100% of federal poverty level. Anything beyond that would already be in SCHIP.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
I guess let me just ask a question rather than delve into the intricacies of life table analysis, which I used to do in a past life. Are you pretty confident that 18,000 steady state is a robust estimate? Because, let me tell you, does everybody have that table? Will we pass that one out?
The poverty level.
What this table shows is that by the time a cohort, this is a table that says if you went to a cohort at a point in time, what percent of them will still be there at different months? So you go to, say, 1, 2, 3, that fourth dot, which is where these lines diverge, and it says about 82% of the population, looks like to me, will still be there, but 18% will have dropped off for some other reason. They've moved, they got into a different program, they got into SCHIP, I mean, whatever it was. So kids are going to drop off routinely, even in a 12-month eligibility period.
Correct.
And so, I mean, it strikes me that moving from 82,000 to 100,000, which is, I think, what we're talking about roughly, is a pretty high estimate of, I mean, that 18,000 seems large to me. But I don't think we can get into the technical analysis, so I might be happy to talk to one of your statisticians.
So
are you pretty confident in that number?
Yes. After
Chair Green, look, I did spend a lot of time looking at it and thinking about it, and based on your questions yesterday, but you know, even before then, and I looked at historically what this caseload has been, and it has been over 100,000 even just 2 years ago. It was over 200,000. So it's not outside of the realm of possibility that the caseload through this action could grow to that level.
Well, wait a minute. You said it's not outside the possibility that it could grow to this level. The question is,
in other words,
what's the likely level that it will grow to?
I think this is the likely level.
Because that's higher than any number we'd heard in horseback estimates. I mean, we did not see any analysis. Okay, good.
Yeah. Are there other questions?
A follow-up to that. Caseload is one issue. Utilization is a very separate issue.
That's correct.
And I don't know how, I mean, my experience with children is a lot less than it is with adults. And when someone comes in to receive medical care, generally, when they get insurance, they utilize it heavily at the very beginning, and then usage tapers off. And I would expect if someone, and this, the dynamic may be totally different, that the utilization would, if they disenroll, then they re-enroll again, that their utilization bumps up the initial months, and then it slides off. And I guess my question is, because I don't know, is do we have any modeling about how this utilization is going to be impacted over time?
If it's capitalized, it doesn't work for the fully capitated. I mean, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
For the fully capitated health plans, because they'll be paid in capitation. And so it's only for the fee-for-service that'll matter, right? Right?
Yes, you are correct. You are correct. But it still would impact the contract negotiations going forward because you now have a different enrollment period.
Yeah, we might actually hear from some of the fully capitated health plans as to whether that's a concern of theirs. That's an interesting point. They may be getting sicker kids. Well, actually,
they've
already been there for 6 months.
Yeah.
So all we're doing is keeping them longer where they made an investment in it. In the sense it might be better.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, and in fact, the sick people tend to stay on the plans they've got. It's the healthy ones that just kind of seem to fade away.
When
they get re-enrolled. So, I mean, I don't know.
I have been reminded by my erstwhile, by my boss here, that we need to be out at 4:30. Is that right?
No.
We will definitely carry this conversation on tomorrow. But let's move on to some other folks. You guys did a great job in getting this analysis to us in the form we wanted. I really appreciate that.
You won't be back tomorrow.
Wouldn't hurt if you were hanging around tomorrow. But let me ask our legislative counsel whether we could get a model set of amendments by tomorrow's meeting that we might actually look at. Is that feasible?
By mostly
deleting? We can talk about it before we're done today. Okay, yeah. It would be great if you were back.
Well,
yeah, except to delete some sections, and to add explicitly that we're talking about Plum kids and not TANF kids here, because Representative Kotek can talk more about that. We believe there are other ways to take care of TANF kids in this. So. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we have legislative counsel here, can I just ask a question on page 2, line 7, the third word? It says the department may not require...
Join us, please.
Thank you. So it's a quick question.
You lawyers always have these complicated questions. We poor humble researchers have trouble keeping up.
Thank you. On page 2, line 7, I'm concerned about the word may, and I'm wondering if it should be shall.
May not? You mean, is the word may not, or?
Yes.
Save the term may not mean shall not.
Oh, God. May and shall. Yes, let's go.
No, it could make a difference.
No, it does.
Yeah.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bonamici, the Foreman style.
Will you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Lori Freeman, Legislative Counsel. In the Office of Legislative Counsel, we've been moving towards trying to be consistent on the use of shall not, or shall and may not. And when you're prohibiting, we say may not. When you're affirmatively trying to make them do something, then it's a shall.
And if it was may in the positive, then it means they can do it or not do it.
Correct.
May not.
But may not does
means
not mean that.
You can't.
We don't have the option.
Interesting. All right. Thank you very much.
While we have our counsel sitting there, is there anything else we want to harass her about? Lori, thank you very much. We have, what do we have? Several, Karen Nadler, Patty Whitney Wise, Andy Miller. Why don't we start with that? And then we'll have Bill Thomas and John Mullen. Yes, to everybody for tomorrow. We only, because of when we announce things, we will only meet at 4 o'clock tomorrow. So we'll meet 30 minutes or, yeah, we didn't schedule tomorrow until 4 o'clock yesterday. So we'll meet from 4 to 4:30 only, and the next day we'll meet in that full session and try and, I would hope we can move this out to Ways and Means by Thursday. If we get amendments that we like and we hear about it. And yeah. That's my current hope. Who's first?
I signed up first, and I couldn't leave. It's the first time I've ever gotten on the schedule first.
And you get to talk first. Go for it.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I represent the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and we have been following this issue through the regular session, and we did testify in favor of Senate Bill 3. However, we didn't like the constitutional amendment part of it, so we didn't support the ballot measure. However, we're happy to see that you're bringing up covering more children again, and we support that effort. It sounds like this bill is probably going to be amended still, so we're maybe a little ahead of the game here, but basically we have policy positions, and our policy position would be the same probably, you know, even if you have amended it. And I have submitted a letter here, and I'll read that into the record. The League of Women Voters is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. The League of Women Voters has a national position to promote a health care system that provides access to a basic level of quality care for all residents and controls health care costs. The League is in favor of universal health care, and SB 3614 is a step in that direction. Oregon has an unacceptable number of uninsured children. An outreach program could enroll children who qualify for the existing state medical assistance program. The federal matching funds are an incentive to expand the number of children covered, and it does bother me to leave that money untouched, too. The League supports maximizing the enrollment of children in the medical assistance program. The League also supports efforts to streamline the process and assistance to families in maintaining this enrollment in OMAP, and also to support the outreach to connect families without medical insurance to the Private Health Partnership Office, which includes the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. There are too many parents who are unemployed or employed without insurance coverage. The League encourages legislators to consider the expansion of this OMAP program to cover additional children and families as a high priority in this special session. This is not a partisan issue. Each legislator has constituents in his or her own district who need this insurance coverage. The League also supports the grant program to improve the access to and effectiveness of health care delivery for families. Thank you for this opportunity to discuss the legislation.
Is she there? Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions? Patty Whitney Wise apparently had to leave but has left a communication from the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force for us, and we'll read that into the record, and it's available to all the committee members and from the business community.
Thank you. Chair Greenlink and committee members, for the record, I'm Andy Miller, Senior Policy Analyst for the Oregon Business Association. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. Oregon Business Association is the leading voice for business in Oregon, advocating bipartisan problem solving with results. OBA is made up of members who seek a legislative agenda that rises above narrowly defined interests and strives to look at Oregon as a whole. Our policies are determined through a member-driven committee and board process. The increasing cost of providing health care for employees is of the utmost concern to our members. After considerable research and discussion, the Health Policy Committee recommended the following principle. Oregon Business Association supports universal access to basic health care for humanitarian and public policy reasons. OBA will consider all serious proposals based on sound business principles to move Oregon to this goal. For this reason, we were strong supporters of Senate Bill 329 in the 2007 session. House Bill 3614 addresses two concerns of OBA, uninsured children and a delivery system that cannot meet the increasing health care needs of our state. This bill, if enacted, will bring more children to OHP and keep them there, thus reducing the number of uninsured children. It will also begin to move the health system toward a community-based model that is patient-centered. Both of these outcomes are an investment in health care reform and support the direction of Senate Bill 329 and the Oregon Health Fund Board deliberations. We urge you to pass and fund House Bill 3614.
Thank you. Passing, you're talking to us. Funding, you need to talk to somebody else. You may want to testify to some other unnamed
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, I did ask my new president, Ryan Deckard, if I should put fund in there, and he said most definitely.
Absolutely. Are there any questions, Mandy? Did you say it's the most important business association, or the foremost? What was that? Make sure that was on the record here.
A leading voice.
A leading. Good. That's better.
Problem solving with results.
No. A leading is better. Yes. I thought I heard the leading. Okay. Thank you, Andy. Can we have Bill Thomas and John Mullen, please? If they've held in. They have indeed. Order. Mr. Thomas, you want to start? You were the first in line here.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Greenlink and members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is William Thomas. I'm the director of the Washington County Commission on Children and Families, and I'm here today to represent both the Washington County Commission as well as the Coalition of County Children and Families Commissions, which are, of course, 36 locally appointed citizens' bodies throughout the state of Oregon in all 36 counties. Our local commissions believe that there are a few more important tasks in this special session than for the future of Oregon than to extend health insurance coverage to the thousands of children and youth who do not have such coverage. And we think that the Oregonian got it right in their editorial. I'm sure you've all read that, so I will not repeat that. But I do think that they pointed out that this bill and House Bill 3614 does present some very important public policy issues as well as funding needs. Last week, members of the Coalition of County Children and Families Commissions met in Salem and reviewed LC 62. And we understand you're considering other changes, but the local commission members who were attending the meeting unanimously endorsed this bill and authorized me on their behalf to encourage you to pass HB 3614. At the local level throughout Oregon, those of us who are involved in serving children and families see firsthand the results of the failure to provide health insurance for needy children. I'm going to talk just a moment about some of our experiences in Washington County, because Chair Greenlick is, of course, represents part of Washington County. There in Washington County, there are more than 15,000 uninsured children and youth. This bill would hopefully, if passed at the as the committee is considering, ensure perhaps another 18,000 over the long run might continue. So that would only be a portion of Washington County's children and youth who are uninsured. We've just completed our 2008-13 comprehensive community plan for children and families, which of course the legislature has mandated that all local commissions complete, and increasing access of children to health care, including medical, mental health, dental, vision, and alcohol and drug services, was one of the highest priorities identified by citizens in every community in our county. We have 11 incorporated cities, and half of our population lives in unincorporated Washington County. That was a common theme that we heard from community meetings. We heard everywhere. So this is a clearly, as you know, a major concern of the public. The needs of Washington County children and youth for access to health and mental health care are so great that our commission and children and families and over 20 school and community partners have organized a broad-based coalition to develop school-based health centers, because we think that's an important access model. And our Washington County School-Based Health Center initiative includes all seven school districts in Washington County, as well as the four community hospital systems which operate in our county, Legacy, Providence, Kaiser, and Tuolumne Healthcare, and many other partners. In less than a year, we've secured over $750,000 in financial commitments, of which $640,000 of which was from the private sector, primarily from private health and health insurance plan foundations, to support the development of four new school-based health centers in four different school districts between this year and 2011. As a result of our school community collaboration, I'm very, very pleased to report that the first school-based health center receiving support, we received $30,000 in planning funds from the $2 million appropriated in the 2000 session of the legislature, will open at Tigard High School in April 2008. And I have given you a flyer about that opening, which indicates the broad base of community partnership and funding that we have received from other community partners. But while the Tigard High School-Based Health Center and others can provide access to critically needed health and mental health services, in our country, we know that children and youth must have health insurance to pay for the care they receive. Otherwise, we pay for it out of another pocket through cost shifts to emergency care, through larger subsidies for school-based health centers, because the state subsidy basically covers uninsured kids. Reducing barriers by simplifying the Oregon Health Plan application form is anticipated in Section 1.1 of this bill, which I would concur with Representative Kotak. I hope that the committee in making changes leaves that part in the bill, since it seems to have minimal or no fiscal impact, but does give important policy direction to the department. But increasing simplifying the Oregon Health Plan application and extending the OHP re-enrollment period for at least Plum children and youth from 6 to 12 months strikes local commissions as common sense as well as good policy. The grant program to increase access and effectiveness of local health care delivery for families will allow local communities in Oregon to demonstrate strategies for making a difference in improving access to health care for children. So we think that's an important part of the bill as well. Our coalition urges you to approve House Bill 3614 as quickly as possible with whatever amendments to, in order to get it into a fiscally responsible package, and send it out to action for the House floor and to the Senate as soon as you can. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, I just wanted to thank Bill personally. You know, a year and a half ago, you had one school-based health center and not a lot going on in Washington County. And I have to say, you know, the commission in Washington County has really stepped up to work on this issue. So I'm really pleased to see that you've got one opening up in Tigard, and look forward to more opening up. Thank you for all your hard work.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kotek, thank you, too. We've appreciated the support from the legislature.
Somebody's cell phone. Who's the person? We'll find them.
We appreciate the support from the legislature, and in fact, we anticipate having a second school-based health center opened at Forest Grove High School in January of 2009 at the beginning of the next legislative session.
Thank you. Questions, comments? We have two Washington County representatives here, remember.
Ah, yes. Excuse me.
Oh, you have a piece of Washington County, too.
Yep. I do three. So I apologize for not recognizing you.
I visited Washington County. Very nice.
I've got like a third cousin that lives
there. He just has the rich part of Washington County. Actually, so do I.
People work in my district.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Moen with the Oregon Law Center, and I'm also here today on behalf of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. The Oregon Law Center works on behalf of economic and social justice issues for low-income Oregonians, and as such, we've been involved in the Oregon Health Plan since day one and before that point in time. The Oregon Health Plan remains a program that is of great service to low-income individuals and families in state. In addition, we took House Bill before the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, and we decided to go ahead and support this bill as well. The Human Services Coalition of Oregon, I'm one of the founders. We've been around since about 1985, about 60 organizations that belong, and we work on broad-based human service issues, and we decided to support this bill because the idea about eligibility and access and increasing the numbers of people that could be served under the Oregon Health Plan was important, and also testing out the medical home model seemed to us to be an idea worth pursuing. So the Human Services Coalition is very supportive of this, but I have to also say in ending my testimony that I thought it was a simple matter of coming up here and saying that I was supportive, but the discussion today about issues relating to caseload, budget, and outreach is an important discussion, and we welcome more of that kind of discussion in the future. I draw, too, on my experience of running a local agency for 23 years, and the issue of making sure that people understand what services are available rather than having to stumble into them is something that I hold personally very important, and I know that there are always budgetary constraints, but human services programs shouldn't sort of operate by virtue of who happens to be fortunate enough to get the information and know that a program's available. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could correct Mr. Mullen, we prefer not to use the term medical home model.
Yeah, we're trying very hard not to.
We're trying, and so, you know, you can call it a thing, but don't use the
health
term.
Health home, primary care home are among the accepted.
Thank you for that correction.
Thank you very much. I want to read into the record, and I'm not quite sure what to do with it, but we have an email from Thomas Ashenbrenner, who is the president of the Northwest Health Foundation, referencing a conversation both Representative Kotek and I had with Mr. Ashenbrenner, where the Northwest Health Foundation has offered to manage the grant program that we have. And of course, I asked the immediate question as a board member, does that mean, how about you'll match the $1 million grants with it? And he didn't respond to that. One of the interesting things in the DHS report is that if we're talking about $250,000 per site grant, many of those might be matched by Medicaid funds. So we might, in fact, if we keep it in DHS, be able to have a multiplier effect on the community grants by bringing Medicaid match to those that for which the application relates to at least a piece of the Medicaid population. So that has some interesting things in its own right.
Let me
question on this.
Mm-hmm.
Were they saying that for the good of the state and the children, they will do this, or is this an offer that they would just like to have the job and they would get paid for it?
No, I Thomas and I, you know, I'm on their board, so we had this discussion only in a very brief way. I think he means that they could have that using their existing staff. This isn't all that complicated compared to what they do.
Overhead dollars go away.
Well, A, if we can do it, and B, if we
all of a sudden it's
if we lose the Medicaid money, it might not be worth the money. There may be more money in that, but it's. I think it was a real offer, and we'll definitely check the conditions. And their argument is they deal with these kind of grants 50 a year, so it's and they're very similar to do very similar things. So.
And it may be possible that they could be the representative of the state for this one purpose,
right.
And therefore it wouldn't affect Medicaid because they're merely an administration firm.
That might in fact be. And what I'll do if the committee wants is I'll ask Mr. Anschenbrenner to join us on Thursday or to send a representative to talk specifically about what he has in mind. And then we need to find out if it's legal and there's all sorts of issues. But it is a generous grant. He was very enthusiastic about it.
Mr. Chair, and I think out of this grant program, there's a possibility that we may need a CMS waiver for any piece part of it. And so I think that somehow DHS is going to have to be, they can't just be disengaged from it. And so.
Yeah, let's leave that as a question. We can ask them to be thinking about it. Certainly, I think if we ask for Medicaid funds, it might make it even more likely that we need some kind of waiver.
Yes.
Might be. Right.
Let's go dialing for dollars.
Before we leave this, if we're not careful, we will become so concerned about federal match that we eviscerate the whole idea
of being
an innovative approach to try and see what might work.
Yeah.
And so let's not...
We want to caution ourselves against that.
Be careful not to just make it fit into what we're already doing so that we can get a match when we're trying to try to do different things.
Patty, would you just get a sense for us if we will need a waiver, even if we just don't ask...
I want to clarify something.
Okay.
Very quickly.
Please reintroduce yourself.
You make me very nervous out there sometimes. My name is Patricia O'Sullivan, and I'm from DHS. Representative, on the paperwork that you saw yesterday, we corrected some things today. And remember, we had both the grant that we had decided for outreach and the grant, the other grant, the access grants, we had them rolled up. And what Judy and I did not know was that the federal match was only on the outreach grant money, on the access. So we cannot get federal matching dollars for the access grant.
And you're only asking $70,000, I think, for the administrative.
We moved it up to the top so you can kind of see it rolled in up at the top. And that, so the federal match went away. It rolled up into box one.
Well, but I'm talking down at the bottom in box four.
There's
a grant administration, which is a relatively small amount of money.
Right. Representative Greenlick, that's correct. At this point, it's I think $50,000 for the first biennia, or $60,000, and then $100,000 because you have to do the monitoring. You have a lot of requirements in there. It's a pretty stringent grant program. So, but again, that's the piece that we did not have public health take a second look at. I'm not saying that it will be lower, but we need to take a second look at that piece.
But possibly that's the 170 or something that we 160 that we might be able to. If we found some other way to deal with it, then, yeah, it is actually money. It's equivalent to the whole
thing. I just didn't want you to go down the wrong road on the Medicaid. That
Thank
was
you
our
very
mistake.
Much.
So.
So there is not going to be a Medicaid match on this, likely. Is that right?
Chair Greenlick, that's correct.
Good. Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, because I know we need to wrap up, but are we coming back tomorrow at 4 to keep continuing to talk about this bill? And I know we need to move on amendments, but... I wanted to throw something out there that I'm not wedded to either way, but in mulling over what the family physician said when they came and testified on the bill around the grants, wondering if the committee would want to consider designating two of the four grants to rural and or frontier areas, try to get at some smaller areas to look at different things. So I just wanted to throw that out there, and if maybe we should have an amendment drafted that effect.
Separate amendment to draft.
Well, just in case we
that.
Wanted to do that,
good.
It was ready.
Good idea.
And then do we want to put a number in here, a dollar amount?
Yeah, I think we do.
Okay.
Yeah, that's sort of confusing as well.
She has a good idea.
And we've been talking about a quarter of a million for a while.
But,
okay. But in closing, let me point something out. If we can believe some numbers that we have in front of us, we may accidentally have stumbled on a very powerful tool. And to say, remain a little skeptical. If we believe the number that there were 60,000 kids that are really eligible for Medicaid, that we heard in the debates on healthy kids, and if we believe that we can really, by simply moving from 6 to 12 months, add 18,000 kids to this program, which would be 30% of all the eligible kids, thinking of the 60% number, and we can do it for, if the estimates are right, something like $10 million a year, $20 million a biennium in roll-up costs, we've actually, this could really take us a long way in a scale that's not 20 million in the 2009-11 budget is not an impossible amount of money. And if we literally could solve the problem of moving 30% of the eligible uninsured kids into the program with this one simple technique, we may be really doing something important with very little impact on the 2007-09 budget. But that's something that we need to think about as we move forward, because we also were sort of committed to saying, well, those kids are out there, let's get them, and if these numbers are right, then we could be doing something really important. With that, we have on tomorrow's agenda both HJR 100 and 3614. We obviously won't have time to get to HJR 100 tomorrow, so if anybody was planning to come in to testify on that, don't bother. We only have a half an hour. Hopefully we'll have some amendments in front of us. As a co-tech, I don't see Ms. Freeman here anymore. Would you ask her to prepare that other and to fill in the basic set of amendments, the $250,000 per grant? If you do that, I appreciate that. And we will close the meeting. Thank you all very much.